From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Kay Corey, who is a member of the Virginia House of Delegates. We'll also be talking with Jamie Raskin, who is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. And we'll be talking with the delegate from the District of Columbia to the U.S. House of Representatives, Eleanor Holmes Norton. But first, Tom Sherwood, what is going on or continues to go on with now being described as embattled D.C. Council member Jack Evans, because there are people who are asking for him to resign, and activist Adam Eidinger is starting a recall campaign. He has to go out and get petitions against Jack Evans, but there has been no conclusion to any investigation yet at this point.
You know, no matter who you are, if you're a public official, you do not want the word embattled to be seemingly permanently engraved in front of your name. But Jack Evans faces on Tuesday, he's a longtime Ward 2 council member, first elected back in 1990. He faces a reprimand by the council, carries no punishment other than the fact he's reprimanded for using his council email account to solicit business from local law firms here in the District of Columbia. That vote is set on Tuesday. There are some council members who happen to be right now meeting in a private retreat at the Washington Convention Center, an annual retreat. They're discussing racial equity and anti-Semitism as part of their major focus today. But some of the council members want to take stronger action against Jack Evans on Tuesday and strip him of his committee chairmanship of the Finance and Revenue Committee, among other committees, because of their concerns. Because it's not only the ethics issue of using his email, but there's a federal probe into Jack's business associations, and the entire government virtually has gotten subpoenas now to preserve documents relating to various businesses that Jack may be serving with. So the big vote is coming Tuesday.
It's an ongoing situation. Joining us now by phone is Eleanor Holmes Norton, delegate to the U.S. House of Representatives from the District of Columbia. Congresswoman Norton, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you, Kojo and Tom.
Well, Ms. Norton, can we ask you, just because I talked about Jack, you were elected the same year. Can I just ask you, I know you've known him, you've worked with him on any number of major business development issues in the city, Yards Park and Southwest Washington and other places. What is your own concern as you watch that unfold?
Well, Tom sure is a friend, and he and I are the longest serving, whatever that means. But I tell you one thing I'm not going to do is put my thumb on the scale one way or the other. I say to Congress, stay out of D.C.'s business, and I set the example. I say, follow me. So I'm not deep into this except what I read in the newspaper. So I'm going to leave it to the district. Let the district think that the Congress is in this matter.
Well, here's what you're deep into. Last week, the House voted on the For the People Act, which, among other things, includes an endorsement of statehood for the District of Columbia. What exactly would this act do?
Well, this is really very important now. It is a run-up, a prelude to H.R. 51 itself, which is, do you get that, H.R. 51?
We got it. 51st state, for those who are having
the 51st state, our statehood bill, to be in the findings, which is essentially a comprehensive pro-democracy bill, which we may think we have democracy. We do. We still have many, many flaws. I mean, one of the things that most appeals to me, we don't have a problem like this in the District of Columbia, but it faces me in the Congress, is that it has H.R. 1 says that the way to combat gerrymandering is to have independent commissions rather than members of politicians, rather, do that configuration. So it's issues of that kind. So to be in that bill means that the District of Columbia is the only local jurisdiction in this bill, which is really about democracy for the nation. And it doesn't have H.R. 1 in it. That's not the way it works. It doesn't have statutes in it. But it has something even more important. It has findings. In other words, it lays out the case for why the District of Columbia should be the 51st state. It makes the case in a pro-democracy bill that the Congress regards as so important that it's made it H.R. 1. And if you look at statehood itself, in less than 3 months, well, we've hardly been here, less than 3 months, we've made more progress than we've made in 218 years, because we now have 201 co-sponsors and co-sponsors. We are in H.R. 1. We have been promised a vote on the House floor. We believe that vote will take place either late this year or early next year. We are still trying to get new members. We got many new members, but we have this problem with new members. Like most Americans, polls show, most Americans think that the district residents have the same rights they have. So we are working on new members who are coming on. I'm very pleased to say.
Here's Tom Sherwood.
Congresswoman, the Senate, controlled by the Republicans, has no interest in this bill. Whatever the appeal, and Jamie Raskin is here, he's one of the biggest, strongest supporters for statehood in the District of Columbia, and maybe he could talk on this, but the Senate is not going to take this up. So what's next?
The Senate is not going to take up trivial bills. So if way in which you got things done in the Congress was to wait until you had 60 members of the Senate, nothing would happen in the House. This makes us, as far as I'm concerned, more than halfway there, because it's such a, if we get through the House, it'll bring tremendous pressure, because it will mean that districts in these senatorial states, in these Senate states, have on board for statehood. I'm the first to admit how difficult it is to get statehood through the House. Through the Senate, but you got to go one House at a time, Tom.
Okay.
You care to comment on this, Jamie Raskin?
It's been interesting to me how open all of these new members are to talking about statehood, not just for D.C., but for Puerto Rico, too. People understand that there are millions of Americans who live under our flag and pay taxes and are law-abiding citizens.
Fight in wars
and so on, and 700,000 right in D.C. who are not represented. And so I think that it's a very good sign for D.C. statehood and for of Eleanor's hard work that we are where we are now.
Nevertheless, Congresswoman Norton, we got an email from Greg who says, as a former D.C. teacher and parent, I support retrocession for the educational advantages it would provide. We'd have access to a state university system, including historically black colleges, and we'd be able to drop the D.C. tag, which is a placebo for a real system. Why does Congresswoman Norton continue to push for a charade of a solution?
Well,
I knew you'd like that.
I'd love to see your face right now.
I love it. I very much appreciate that caller, because it allows me to make clear that at the time we're getting democracy, we don't want to take democracy away from another state. Maryland is too nice to say it, although I do have some figures showing where their state legislators stand on retrocession. And for your listeners, the retrocession means that since the district came from Maryland, it would be reincorporated into Maryland. Maryland doesn't want it. District really doesn't want it. In more than 200 years, we have taken on a flavor of our own. We are really our own people now. So that is even further away. In fact, it's nowhere on the list, because you have to convince two groups of people. You'd have to convince the District of Columbia and the state of Maryland. Don't make it harder than it already is.
Well, maybe Virginia got its portion of the district back in 1848 because it wanted to protect slavery. Maybe we could get Northern Virginia back into the district, and then we'd really do have something.
I am not even going there, because we don't have time. But quickly, Congresswoman Norton, this week the president signed a congressional lands bill that changes how D.C. can manage its federally controlled parks. What exactly is going to change?
Yeah, that means a lot to the district, and we already have Park Downtown ready to go. What it means for the district is that we have the authority to work with the National Park Service to begin rehabilitating our parks. The National Park Service owns all of our parks. Now, you will note that we haven't asked to take back those parks. We don't mind them owning them. They keep them up, but they don't do anything with them because they're the most underfunded area, that National Park Service agency. That is, they're the most underfunded agency in the federal government. So if we want to do something about our neighborhood parks, if we want to do something about the parks downtown, we're going to have to get the district, and in this case, we're working with the business community for the parks downtown to rehabilitate those parks. Considering how many parks there are in the district, and this is one of the great amenities of the district, this could really matter to the district. And the reason I know it matters is the moment this bill began to move, people tweeted the hell out of what it meant to them to get this bill through. People want their parks rehabilitated. They want the National Park Service and the district government to get on with it. And now we're able to do it.
Eleanor Holmes Norton is the delegate to the U.S. House of Representatives from the District of Columbia. Congresswoman Norton, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Kojo.
Joining us in studio is Jamie Raskin. He's a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. Jamie Raskin, welcome.
Delighted to be with you and with Tom Sherwood.
Supporting D.C. statehood isn't the only thing that the For the People Act that passed the House last week would do. It touches on voting and an issue that is particularly sensitive in Maryland, gerrymandering. The For the People Act deals with partisan gerrymandering, an issue Marylanders know well. Its 6th congressional district has been found to have been drawn by Democrats in a way that unconstitutionally targeted Republican voters. How do you think, given the in context of what was voted in the House, that how do you think Maryland should move forward from here?
Well, this is the lead provision in H.R. 1. What we're trying to do is to end gerrymandering, the practice of politicians choosing their voters before the voters choose the politicians. And so we would mandate independent redistricting panels in every state across the union. Now, amazingly, we got no Republican support for this. Not a single Republican is supporting the end of gerrymandering, and we know why. They control a supermajority of the state legislatures, and they've made a practice out of gerrymandering, which isn't to say that Democrats' hands are clean, because Democratic legislatures have done the same thing.
We want to get 6th district in Maryland, to be specific.
Well, every district, in a sense, is gerrymandered because politicians are controlling the computer technology, which allows you to decide not only, you know, which communities are in the district, but which individuals are in the district. And we've seen some, you know, outrageous manipulations of the map. So what we're proposing is that you have independent, nonpartisan, expert redistricting commissions that are drawn of citizens and other voting experts, and no politicians, no elected officials at all be involved. And that's what we're fighting for. But we got no support from the GOP, which some members have started to call the gerrymander-only party, because they are so clinging to this antiquated and obsolete way of doing business. But
can I ask about the commission? Because it sounds like a great thing. You get independent, nonpartisan people who I would presume would be appointed by a governor and then affirmed by the legislature. But then wouldn't that just be shifting the politics of it? I can't. On what basis would they draw the lines?
There are different ways that it could be done, but the key provision is that you don't have elected officials in it and you don't have partisan control over the members. I mean, the California system is one that has worked quite well and was passed with overwhelming bipartisan support. There are a bunch of states that have adopted the independent model. The problem, of course, is that it doesn't get you all the way there, because if you have a 60-40 split in a state and you smoothly spread that around a state, the 60% party would end up with 100% of the seats, which means the 40% party gets nothing,
right?
Not 40% of the seats. That's a problem with single member districts. And so I'm hoping that we can move not only to independent redistricting panels, but multi-member districts that would allow a better representation, so you don't get some all Republican states, as Utah was up until recently, or all Democrat states the way Massachusetts is, even though it's got a Democratic governor. We really should have a greater political diversity within the delegations.
Mark in Silver Spring wants to weigh in on this issue. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Quickly, by the way, the Questionable District does look like a Dali painting. Two quick questions. One, when we buy a car, do we just kick the tires or do we look under the hood? That is, with voting machines, do we just look at the surface or the software? Secondly, Russians are known for misinformation and hacking. And when Manafort showed them polling data, was that just for misinformation purposes or also for hacking?
Well, I personally never kicked the tires of a car I was buying, but Jamie, that's your turn.
Well, I appreciate the call. I actually just got back from a great conference taking place at GW this morning on by the Election Verification Network, which is voting rights advocates and computer experts from around the country who are talking about the vulnerabilities of our election system. You know, what happened in 2016 was that Vladimir Putin, the former chief of the KGB, knew that he could not beat America's military-industrial complex or our economy or our political philosophy, but he found our Achilles heel, which is the internet and our technological vulnerability. So he set up something like a Manhattan Project to figure out how to invade our computer systems, and they did it at the DNC, and they hacked tens of thousands of emails, which altered the course of the campaign. They injected poison into our political culture through lots of propaganda that was entered into Facebook and Twitter and the other social media to try to divide Americans and polarize the country. And then they actually tried to hack directly into election systems. And so we have every reason to believe that they're coming back again, along with other authoritarian bad actors that are trying to destabilize the democracy. So I'm hoping that of the many excellent pieces of H.R. 1 that we can lift up and actually get the Senate to address, one of them will be this whole question of election security to make sure that our democracy doesn't get hacked again.
Speaking of elections, you're a progressive, proud progressive Democrat. The Republicans are trying to rename you guys socialists. What is your thoughts about, you know, the president and the and Republican Party members saying the Democrats are swinging so far left that they're going to commit political suicide by being seen as socialists in this country? Are you a socialist?
No, I am not, and I'd be very happy to describe my political philosophy if you want to have me back for another hour.
We don't have much time.
But let's start with this. The Republican Party, for the last century or more, has described any progressive measure as socialism. So they describe Social Security as socialism. They describe Medicare, Medicaid, the minimum wage, the National Labor Relations Act, and the right of people to organize. You name it, they call it socialist. So I think the American public understands that. In fact, the real socialists in America are the Republicans and the largest banks and corporations, which use state funds to bail themselves out every time they crash the economy. So I would just turn that charge around.
Let me ask you another quick political question. Governor Hogan, the Republican governor of Maryland, 70% popularity, has been to Iowa. He's going to New Hampshire. He's playing, toying with, or considering running against President Trump. What do you think about that?
More power to him. You know, that would be that would be a Hogan move I could really get behind. Look, I think it is shameful, the supine acquiescence of the members of the Republican Party to every outrage and scandal of the Trump administration. It is amazing to me how few Republicans have spoken out about the president's equivocation between neo-Nazi marchers and anti-Nazi protesters, how few have denounced him for his outrageous, unconstitutional, banana republic-style declaration of an emergency, totally overriding the will of Congress and attempting to usurp our power over appropriations in the federal budget. You know, every day we see another scandalous offense against our constitutional values, and most Republicans are completely sheep-like in going along with it. And if Governor Hogan wants to go out there and take a stand against Donald Trump, more power to him.
Well, Robin emails the usual Tom Sherwood, this is the politics hour question about your own future plans. Robin says, can Jamie Raskin run for president? I'm ready to support that campaign.
Well, that's very sweet. If I could run for president and not leave the mid-Atlantic states, I would. If I could stay in Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland, Virginia, D.C., Delaware. I'm not a big frequent flyer. I don't like flying all over the country. And the truth is, I love my job in the House of Representatives. And, you know, I love our speaker, Nancy Pelosi. But one thing that she keeps saying that I disagree with is that we are a co-equal branch of government. We are not a co-equal branch of government. The Congress is the lead branch of government. We are Article One. We represent the people. We make the laws. The president's sole job is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed and to be the servant of implementing the will of Congress. So I very much appreciate the caller's call, and I don't mean to...
And I'm very glad you raised that issue, since you're an expert in constitutional law. You may be able to answer Paul in Rockville, Maryland. Paul, your turn.
The question I have is, if D.C. becomes a state and they split out the district as just around the government agencies, what happens to the three electoral votes that the constitutional amendment gave to the district?
It's a great question. The 23rd Amendment has a provision which says that Congress has the power to implement the provisions of the 23rd Amendment. So Congress could act by statute simply to disorganize the presidential electoral process. And then at that point, a constitutional repeal process could be set in place, as with the repeal of prohibition. Obviously, it's a little bit messy, but I think that's what you would have to do.
Right now in the General Assembly, there's of Maryland, there's a tough fight to change the minimum wage, to raise it. Governor Hogan has a slower move to $15
an hour.
Yep. The Senate has passed one provision that would give companies with 15 employees or fewer longer time. The House has passed $15 by 2025, I believe. It seems to me the real problem is the federal government has not raised the minimum wage from $7.25 to, I think, 2008 or 2009. Is there any hope that this Congress will address that, and that you can get the Republicans to go along?
Absolutely. I think that's very much on the agenda. A lot of the new members of Congress got elected campaigning for a $15 minimum wage, and we want to do it in a way, as you suggest, Tom, that doesn't break the bank for small businesses that are just getting started, that have fewer employees. But I think that there's a pervasive sense in our party that the economic inequality in America today is indefensible, and it is a threat to having a democracy. You know, it's very hard to run a real one-person, one-vote democracy where there are such extremes in terms of people's ability just to sustain themselves in their lives.
Campaign contributions. You introduced an amendment in the For the People Act called Shareholders United that deals with corporate contributions to campaign. Obviously, that would affect elections around the country and in Maryland. What would it do, and why introduce it now?
Well, the Citizens United decision remains a deeply controversial and unpopular one, and we really have not come up with any effective way of dealing with Citizens United. A vast majority of the people would like to see the decision repealed, either by the Supreme Court, to have the court reverse it, or to repeal it with a constitutional amendment. But in the meantime, my thought was to say, look, let's take the decision seriously. Justice Kennedy said that the premise of the opinion is that the corporations can spend whatever money they want in politics because they're speaking for the shareholders. So they are the vicarious voice of the shareholders. Well, the problem, of course, is not only do the shareholders not have any actual say in where this money is going to be spent or whether it's going to be spent, they don't even know about it. So Shareholders United says that corporations that want to spend money in politics, if the CEOs want to get in the business of spending money in politics, they essentially have to get a majority vote of the shareholders to make it happen. They have to be able to assess the preference of the shareholders, either through a direct proxy vote or through some kind of polling apparatus, to determine what the shareholders want. But we want to undo this charade of saying, oh, well, the CEOs have the right to spend millions of dollars because they're speaking for the shareholders, but then the shareholders not knowing anything about it.
I suspect conservatives would say, why shouldn't unions have to do the same thing?
Unions do have to do the same thing, in fact. In fact, it's even a tougher rule for unions. If a member of a union doesn't like the way the union is spending their money on politics, they get a rebate for it. Under our plan, if you're in a minority of shareholders that doesn't want it spent, if a majority does want it spent, you couldn't get a rebate. I mean, that, in fact, some people said to me, well, why shouldn't I be able to get a rebate if I don't want my money spent that way? But it appeared to be too difficult, at least at this point, to accomplish that.
People watching television today are looking at some of the video from New Zealand. There's some horrific video that everyone is agreeing not to show. We're Sandy Hook in this country. Children were shot dead in their school back in 2012, I believe. Where are we politically on? I know you're progressive and want gun control, but their court ruled this week that the parents of Sandy Hook can sue the Remington manufacturer. There's a lot going on, but it doesn't seem we're making any progress towards mass gun violence and guns in this country.
Well,
where are we on that politically?
We're making some progress in the House of Representatives. Last week, we passed our H.R. 8, which is an attempt to close the loopholes that remain in the background check legislation, the Brady Bill. We know that there were loopholes that were built into that for internet sales, for private gun sales, and for private gun show sales, where you could go to a gun show and then... we know that millions of guns are sold that way, and lots of them end up in crime and in murders. So we have voted to close those loopholes and to guarantee a universal criminal and mental background check to make sure that all gun sales have to go through the Brady background check process. We also closed the Charleston loophole, which is what made the Charleston massacre possible, which gives people the right to get the gun if the background check is still taking place for more than 3 days.
We
closed that loophole too.
We probably should have started with this, but could you comment on Harry Hughes, the former governor of Maryland?
Well, I was going to end with that.
Oh, you're going to end with it?
Yes,
we'll talk
about that before he leaves. That's going to be the last thing we talk about.
Kojo is the host of the show, I'd like to point out.
Yes, but Tom takes the initiative more often than I do. You authored a resolution condemning anti-Semitism last week. That resolution has been controversial, with some Democrats unhappy about the process, some progressives seeing it as attacking Representative Ilhan Omar unfairly, though her name was never mentioned, and Republicans, including the president, saying it wasn't strong enough. Why did you author the resolution, and what do you think about the response to it?
Well, look, Kojo, this whole field is way too important and grave to deal with in terms of the usual partisan point scoring. There is rising anti-Semitism all over the world, and it's very serious business. And there is rising racism and white nationalism all over the world, as we saw tragically in this New Zealand massacre by a self-avowed fascist and racist who put his manifesto online. This is really serious. Over the last several weeks, I've been to the Holocaust Museum with a group of members that I took there for them to see a new exhibit, which is a wonderful exhibit about what was taking place in America during the rise of fascism. I've been to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Israel, and I've been to the new lynching memorial, which is in Alabama with Congressman John Lewis, and we saw the new Legacy Museum there, which is about the history of race, hate, and violence in America. Look, we have a responsibility to denounce expressions and actions of hatred wherever they're coming from. And some people were very motivated by Ilhan Omar's comments. Other people were motivated by the attack on her, which was embodied in a poster that linked her to the 9/11 attacks and basically associated her with Al-Qaeda. And other people are still smarting over the president's remarks about the Charlottesville murder of Heather Heyer and the neo-Nazi marches there. You know, when the Republicans were in control of the House, we introduced a resolution to denounce the president for those remarks, and the majority did not allow us to get that on the floor. And so there's all of this finger pointing, and people are upset. And, you know, I've spent enough time in academia, Kodjo, to know a identity politics imbroglio when I see one. And I could see that people were factionalizing and balkanizing in different ways. And I said, look, we don't need to move this thing to the left. We don't need to move this thing to the right. We need to lift it up out of the muck and to have a universal denunciation of racism and anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim bigotry and white nationalism. And I think this was the most forceful and comprehensive denunciation of anti-Semitism in the history of the U.S. Congress. It was the first denunciation of anti-Muslim bigotry and violence in the history of the U.S. Congress. And it was a very powerful statement. And I know there were people who wanted us to go after this person or that person, but I think the issues are way too great
for that. What about going after the internet? Elizabeth Warren, among others, who's running for president, has talked about we need to regulate online Facebook and other places. We need to have some kind of regulation because the dissemination of a sewage level hate and discrimination is running amok online. There's worries about censorship, of course, but you know, we had to worry about regulating radio. We regulated television. We got rid of the fairness doctrine. But what can be done to address this mainstream gutter level spread of hate and other vicious stuff? I mean, the New Zealand guy put it online.
Right.
As he was doing it.
You know, and the internet has been the vehicle, the courier for messages of hate and for organizing by the white supremacist groups. The good news is that they still represent a small fraction of the American people, and I think people internationally, but they've been able to find each other and connect through the internet. I mean, you know, the constitutional standard is embodied in the Brandenburg case. It's about incitement to imminent lawless action, incitement to violence. And so when speech gets to that point, when it's a direct threat, then it loses the protection of the First Amendment. And that's pretty much the international standard that now focuses on the problem of speech advocating hate and violence. Because, and I think we can work with that.
And because we're almost out of time, I think I'm looking for a yes or no answer to this question. Speaking of racism, there's a push in the Maryland state legislature to repeal the state song, Maryland, My Maryland, the 1861 Ode to the Confederacy. Do you support repealing the song?
Rewrite or repeal, yes.
Okay, rewrite or repeal, yes. And as Tom mentioned earlier, former Maryland Governor Harry Hughes passed this week at the age of 92. Maybe a lot of people don't remember Harry Hughes that well because he was not scandal-plagued, as his two predecessors happened to be, Spiro Agnew and Marvin Mandel. And he had a surprise upset victory when he first became governor. He upset Lieutenant Governor Blair Lee III, who was a part of the Mandel administration. But your thoughts on former Governor Harry Hughes?
Well, Governor Hughes was a man of extraordinary integrity and decency and elegance, and he does represent kind of a vanishing period in the history of our state. And he was quite a beloved guy, and you know, I know that everybody is holding his family and his close friends in their prayers.
I would say he gets a lot of credit for helping start the effort to protect the Chesapeake Bay. Mm-hmm. But also, I just have to report that John Waters, the producer, filmmaker, mm-hmm. he wrote a letter to the Baltimore Sun this week saying that Harry Hughes would always be his hero because Harry Hughes was in office and Hughes refused to renew the Maryland Censorship Board. It had been in place since 1916, and Harry Hughes, I think back in 1981, said he would veto any effort to renew it, and that three-member board that got to see all the dirty movies that we couldn't see was abolished. So John Waters wanted to make sure we said that.
Kodjo, can I mention two other great American leaders we've lost recently?
Yes.
One is Senator Birch Bayh, who we lost just
Indiana.
A couple of days ago from Indiana. And another great Marylander was Senator Joe Tidings, we lost a few months ago, but we miss him very much.
Jamie Raskin is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. He's a Democrat from the state of Maryland. Congressman Raskin, thank you very much for joining.
It's always an honor.
Up next is Kay Corey, who is a member of the Virginia House of Delegates. I suspect this report in the Washington City paper was a surprise to a number of people, Tom Sherwood. It says, the headline, D.C. Central Kitchen loses the bulk of its homeless shelter food service contract. D.C. Central Kitchen has had such a long history in the District of Columbia, preceded by the facility that was created by Mitch Snyder and Carol Fenley in the Community for Creative Nonviolence. And then Robert Egger comes along and creates D.C. Central Kitchen. And it has been well known as an institution that trains people in the culinary arts, especially people who have been down on their luck, some who are returning citizens, male and female and the like. But apparently they lost the contract.
Suddenly, this is an organization to which I don't believe there has been any scandal assigned to it. It works on a very small margin. It has to raise money to make money that it doesn't get from the city. The Partnership for the Prevention of Homelessness puts these contracts out. D.C. Central Kitchen has gotten the contract. They fed 10 different sites, 10,000 meals a day. Suddenly they were told, well, you're not going to have the full contract this time. We're going to give half of it to a new organization, one that's based, I think, in Prince George's County. I don't want to get into too much details of who they are, because I think that the city needs to take a better look at this. Because it's a disruption, could mean the end of the D.C. Central Kitchen. I don't believe they can function on just serving five homeless shelters. And there seems to be no reason. The Partnership for Prevention of Homelessness has not clearly said why it made this substantial change. And literally daily, thousands of meals for homeless people and people in need are at risk here.
Joining us in studio is Kay Corey. She's a member of the Virginia House of Delegates representing the 38th District Delegate. Corey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're wearing a big round button on the lapel of your jacket. It says VA ratify ERA. You were at the forefront of pushing for Virginia to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. First, remind us what the Equal Rights Amendment would do and what the broader national implications would be if Virginia would pass it.
What it would do in Virginia is to give women the legal grounds to protect the rights that, in theory, we already have. You know, equal opportunity, equal pay, choices, control over our healthcare choices also would be a big plus.
Why did the Republicans kill it?
They killed it because, and I'm quoting, because they said that it would mean that you could have free abortions almost on every street corner. That's what they kept talking about. And actually, that's not really true.
Why do you think they oppose it then? If you believe their argument against it is fraudulent, why do you think they oppose it? Is it a lack of respect for women? I mean, be as blunt as possible. This is the politics.
All right. I will be. I honestly don't know exactly why they oppose it, because what the comments they were making on the floor and to the press were what people call dog whistle politics these days. And frankly, if I were the Republican minority in the House's political consultant, I would have told them to pass this with no fuss, because then they would get all the women who voted in the last election for the first time, they would get their vote.
Kojo asked the question, what effect would this have? He had Virginia pass it and would come to, I think, the 38th state to pass it.
Yes.
But others say the deadline to pass this constitutional amendment expired in like 82 or something, like 1982.
Mm-hmm.
So what Yes. practical effect would it have?
Well, first of all, I should refer to our Attorney General, Mark Herring, who said that the deadline didn't really matter. The practical effect at this point, other than legal standing on certain issues to take someone to court, would basically be, I believe, emotional. It has turned into such a partisan battle, such an emotional battle. A couple of years ago, the Republican majority wouldn't even let us present the bill in committee. And we progressed from there, but it was an awful lot of fighting.
Speaking of practical value, you pointed out that ratifying the ERA would also help incarcerated Virginia women in particular. How?
Oh, this is a topic that I'm very happy that you brought up. Women in Virginia have been incarcerated at an increasingly high rate. It's around 300% increase in the past 4 or 5 years. And our criminal justice system, while not being very just in many ways, is simply not equipped to handle women or any of the medical or daily needs that they have. Last year, I was fortunate enough to get a bill passed that said that women in prison or jail in Virginia could have menstrual products without cost. Previously, they had to pay for those products and sometimes prove that they had used what they already had been given. So, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You're the guest.
One of the problems women in prison in Virginia have is medical care. It's not only reproductive, but medical care in general. And it's, I had a bill, but that's another story.
All right, well, here's Tom Sherwood.
You have an opponent in the primary.
Yes.
But will this ERA matter be part of the Democratic pitch in the fall elections? And also, I've got to ask you, what is the effect you're seeing in you're in central Fairfax County?
Yeah.
What is the impact of the troubles Governor Northam is having, Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax is having, that the Attorney General you mentioned is having over the blackface issues and the sexual assault issues? How is that affecting the campaigns as you go forward? Because you have a Lieutenant Governor accused of sexually abusing two women. You're talking about the rights of women. It seems to me this gets all discombobulated in trying to run a campaign. Where is it?
I heard a number of questions there. So I think the prevalent theme in what you just asked me was how are all the scandals basically in Richmond involving our governor, lieutenant governor, and AG affecting the campaign trails at this point? And then you also asked if the ERA would be an issue. In my district and in Northern Virginia in general, I do not think that the ERA will be an issue, except the questions you're asking me, like why didn't it pass and why did it become such a partisan issue?
Well, we have a caller about that I'll get to shortly, but go ahead.
Oh,
well, and the scandals?
The scandals, again, Virginia is so many different commonwealths rolled into one that I have only been hearing from constituents who asked me to tell everybody stop paying attention to this stuff and get the budget passed and do what we sent you there to do. And honestly, I am not hearing anyone urging me to urge anybody to leave their office.
Back to the ERA. Here's Katie, who is south of Richmond in Midlothian, Virginia. Katie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I am calling about the Equal Rights Amendment and looking forward already towards 2020 and another shot for Virginia to be the 38th state. I note that it's the centennial year for the 19th Amendment, and it seems like everybody's really ready to celebrate that, including many of the Republicans who did not pass the ERA. And I just wanted to point out that the author of the Equal Rights Amendment is the same woman that we celebrate for getting us the 19th Amendment. And until we get her vision fully into the Constitution, it's interesting to me that so many Republicans who wouldn't get her vision into the Constitution are, you know, on committees and such to celebrate the centennial of the 19th Amendment and her. And that would be Alice Paul.
And you're looking forward to 2020. It seems to me that Delegate Corey is nodding in agreement. She's apparently looking forward to 2020 also.
I am. I am definitely looking forward to 2020. It might even be more interesting than the most recent session. But there is a major expectation that we will have a few more Democrats in either the House or the Senate.
Earlier this week,
it'll make a difference.
Earlier this week, WAMU education reporter Jenny Abam, who published a story looking at the practice of restraining and isolating Fairfax County students in public schools for disciplinary reasons. This is an issue that you are probably familiar with. You were on the Fairfax County School Board for a decade. What's your reaction to the news that this practice has been going on in Fairfax County Public Schools, despite the fact that Fairfax County Public Schools had been reporting to the federal government that it isn't?
My reaction is disappointment and a little bit of surprise. Although I have been hearing this from parents, anecdotes that have been painful to hear and difficult to follow up. And to be fair to Fairfax County Public Schools, one of the largest and actually best in the nation, I think that a number of the administrators who report the data don't understand the categories or the way to report it. I have been looking at this so-called pipeline to prison for minority students, especially in high school, and a lot of the problem that we have in Virginia is that we can't identify the problem. The definitions are so muddied, and reporting is voluntary. And so I'm just saying that that also applies to the restraint and seclusion. However, it is a hateful, hateful practice, even if it doesn't happen very often. It simply is not the way to deal with a special needs student who has become upset.
And both national and state legislatures are looking at it. Josh in Arlington has a question having to do with the climate. Josh, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you for the time for us this question to Delegate Corey. Today's world's students are basically protesting against not doing anything for climate change. And we all know that, for instance, Dominion Energy, it's a company that is overly sourced from fossil fuels. You can just look up in the website.
What would you like to ask Delegate Corey?
Yeah, so Delegate Corey, my question is pretty specific. I mean, you've been received for a long time contributions for your campaign from Dominion Energy. Will you commit to stop receiving contributions for this campaign?
Excuse me, let me interrupt you. I have already made that commitment and signed that statement and have been pushing the new Green Deal for the last year and a half. And I am not taking any contributions from energy companies. So your point is out of date.
Your opponent in the announced opponent in the primary is Andre Jimenez. Is this who's on the phone?
Is that you, Josh, Andre Jimenez?
Oh, no, not at all.
It sounds like is it you or not?
Who is Andre Jimenez?
Yes.
Who is him?
You don't know who Andre Jimenez is?
Oh, no, I don't know.
Your opponent says that it sounds like his voice, but thank you very much for your call.
He's running and he's pitching his campaigning on environmental issues. And
yes,
stuff.
All right. Right.
Have you had a forum with him yet or anything
no,
like that?
No, I haven't. There are several coming up, and actually I look forward to meeting Mr. Jimenez. I am happy to have some younger Democrats participate in the political process. It's just very unusual to have somebody jump in at that level. But I have to point out, for the past 10 years, I've been getting awards from every conservation and environmental organization.
Is there a date certain for your first meeting with your opponent, Mr. Jimenez?
I believe there's a forum on Monday.
Oh,
a community forum this coming Monday.
I mean, I think people should go to the forums. You know,
I do too.
So, can you say very quickly where it is? Or if you don't know, is there a website we can find out?
I don't know if they have a website.
It's where is it?
Bailey's Crossroads Route 7 Revitalization Commission. And it is in the Moose Lodge. I believe it's on I know how to get there, but I believe it's on Magnolia off of Lacey Boulevard.
Okay, voters
it starts
can find
at 7 o'clock. It's on my Facebook page.
Don't have a lot of time left, but you co-sponsored legislation that expanded absentee voting in the Commonwealth. What would that do?
What will it do?
Yes.
It will allow voters to have in-person absentee without excuses, without having to go through all the rigmarole that we make people go through now to prove why they can't vote. It's a very small step, but it is the beginning of increasing access to the polls and increasing the opportunity of voters to have their voices heard. And it was bipartisan this year, which was a shocking and amazing thing.
One of the big things this weekend is the Arlington County Board, is going to meet tomorrow, I think in early afternoon,
yep,
and have testimony, public testimony on Amazon.
Yes.
Amazon pulled out of New York. There's no suggestion that it's going to pull out of Arlington. But you're nearby. Your own district is nearby. Fairfax is nearby.
Yes.
What are you thinking? That I know you want the board to go forward with this. Any thoughts particularly on Amazon?
You have about a minute left.
Okay. I believe that in the long run, Amazon will be a boost for our community. But in the short term, we really have to protect the existing low-income housing communities that we have and be sure that those people don't get pushed out when the more highly paid workers for Amazon come in.
Kay Corey is a member of the Virginia House of Delegates representing the 38th District. She is a Democrat. Delegate Corey, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Tom Sherwood, quickly here, the lawsuit that the city had against the D.C. Hospital, against Providence Hospital over its closure, the Attorney General has dropped that lawsuit, which means that the hospital is gone and no lawsuit.
This hospital dates back to Abraham Lincoln, but there was no good case to by the city to stop it from doing what it wants to do, which is to close and change the way it's going to provide emergency care. It's part of the overall hospital crisis in the District of Columbia, including how fast they'll build a new hospital over near St. Ease.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Today we were pleased to have in our control room watching the show Marlene Singer and Yahel Cannon, two guests who just happened to drop by today. Thank you very much for dropping by. Today's Politics Hour is produced by Mark Gunnery. Coming up Monday, we'll explore the landscape of live jazz venues in the city. What does their availability say about the past, present, and future of local jazz? It's all part of our series on gentrification in D.C.'s arts community, culminating in a roadshow next Tuesday at Arena Stage. It all starts Monday at noon. Tom Sherwood, what are your plans between now and
then? I think I might get to the Arlington Board to watch some of that discussion, and I'll be there Tuesday at Arena Stage because I can walk to it.
Man never
stops. Save me a seat.
The man never stops working. So, see you at Monday at noon. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nam.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.